So we have an empirical overview in terms of trafficking cultural property, and there are broadly two types of empiricism which would underpin something that we might call an empirical overview of the problem. There is the empirical reality of looting and trafficking prosecutions and convictions, as they are known to prosecutors and lawyers and judges and police. And the second type of empiricism is the type of evidence that academics produce and work with, research findings, in other words, which are considered to be robust and valid according to conventionally accepted standards of methodological competence. And it's this second type of empirical overview that I will be giving you today, and I'll leave the police and the prosecution discussions to the representatives here who are closer to that information in their work. As well as empiricism, I want to offer a review of the theoretical landscape. So this is the empirical and theoretical overview, albeit a restricted overview of the theory. Among the many writers who have provided commentary and analysis on this problem, there are several criminologists who have used a variety of theoretical perspectives to try to explain the causes of the market. And the different perspectives used by way of explanation tend towards suggesting different solutions to the problem. So I want to review the main theories stated or implied in the criminological literature, which is engaged with the types of solutions that they've suggested. So, this is a terribly busy slide, I'm afraid, but you'll see it again and again. And I'll take you through it part by part. Academic research can be quantitative or qualitative, in other words, statistical or interpretive. And research into trafficking looted antiquities can be separated for analytical purposes between studies which look at source issues around looting and those which look to the market. So we can categorize the evidence base on these dimensions as qualitative or quantitative, and as dealing in the main with source issues or market issues. And that's what we've done here in this diagram, which represents our impression of some of the major empirical studies that have been done into these various aspects of the market. As well as empirical studies, which take place in the top two lines of the diagram, there are other studies, which we're here calling professional commentaries. These may be legal analyses or papers which recommend policy developments, or in a few cases, theoretical discussions. And we've included these in our literature review, although in a strict construction of an evidence review, they may not have qualified. It's harder to categorize these legal, policy, and theoretical documents and papers according to the source and market divide, since they tend by their nature to look across the source and the market, which is why they sit in the center of the diagram there on the bottom row. So let's work our way through this evidence-based sequentially using this outline analytical framework, beginning with quantitative source research, in other words, attempts to quantify the looting problem, and then moving on to quantification of issues in the market, and then we'll look at the qualitative side of things. I should also say the title of this conference is National and International Dimensions. This is predominantly an international literature review, in the sense that I'm looking across broadly a global literature, but unfortunately restricted to English language literature, although perhaps that's an understandable restriction. So quant source studies, here we're dealing with the top left corner of the diagram. The majority of quant source studies have been archaeological site-related, so we'll start there. Archaeological site surveys consist of pedestrian or aerial land survey. Pedestrian survey basically means walking across a site in a structured way, observing the surface of the ground for relevant information. And this is done by archaeologists, and it's mainly, therefore, a technique for looking for information that might add to the historical record, rather than collecting evidence of damage to the site caused by looting. But in the course of their work, some archaeologists have recorded looting damage as part of their pedestrian surveys. And also, some researchers have turned to satellite imagery, which these days is readily available and through services like Google Earth is free, while pedestrian survey is time-consuming and expensive. I've got some pictures to demonstrate the sorts of things that you can find by either pedestrian or aerial photography or satellite imagery. This is a site in Iraq. The more structured part is the legitimate archaeological dig, and all of the holes around it are holes that are dug by looters looking for objects. This is the same site from a higher level aerial photograph. This is a similar sort of situation sent to us by an archaeologist in Jordan, and as part of the project that we currently have at Glasgow, we are regularly receiving evidence like this from archaeologists around the world who take pictures of sites that they're working on which have been looted. This is the other sort of thing you can find. I suppose this is pictures that date back to the 1960s, which show how large facades can be taken off, in this case a Mayan temple in South America. And often these days archaeologists won't have access to this sort of direct evidence, but they will be able to take pictures of saw marks often which are left on the buildings to show that things have been removed in this way. So here are some examples from the top left quadrant of studies and projects using satellite images to record and analyse levels of looting in source countries. After the 2003 invasion of Iraq, Elizabeth Stone utilised satellite imagery to survey and document the destruction of the Iraqi archaeological landscape. She captured the full-scale extent of the devastation from a bird's-eye view and observed that looting patterns changed over time and that these changes can be tracked. Carrie Fritz, in 2008, used satellite imagery similarly, and Daniel Contreras and Neil Brody, the references up there are to 2012 and 2010, two papers in 2010. These guys have arguably written the most about this method and its use for academic studying this aspect of illicit antiquities trafficking. They've produced a very large archive of pictures, data, and analysis using Google Earth, and we're in the process of formatting that for publication on our website at the Trafficking Culture Project at Glasgow. And then also in the top quadrant, there are references to studies which don't use satellite analysis. We can mention some of the more significant ones. Allian Conningham, in 1998, surveyed the Charsada area in Pakistan and found that over 50% of Buddhist sacred sites had been badly looted. Christiana Panella and colleagues in 2005 surveyed an area of Mali and found that out of 830 known sites, 45% were looted. And in another area they studied, the figure was 52%. Roosevelt and Luke in 2006 surveyed burial sites in western Turkey and found 397 sites. And out of these, 90% were looted and 52 were totally demolished. Roosevelt and Luke surveyed another area called Bintep and found 111 burial sites, and of these, 96% were looted, and some of them were damaged by heavy machinery. Mark Gutchen in 1983 found that 59% of all Mayan sites in Belize showed evidence of looting, and one could go on. The other type of quantitative study of the source end of the chain of supply, besides aerial photography and pedestrian survey of looting, has been a survey of archaeologists themselves. The major contributor here is Blythe Bowman Prue, who surveyed archaeologists' experiences and perceptions around the issue of looting. In 2008, she emailed a structured questionnaire to over 14,000 archaeologists working around the world, and she got a sample return of about 2,500. The majority of archaeologists surveyed, 79% of them, reported having direct experience with looting at sites that they'd worked on. Looting was found not to be a problem confined to poor countries. In fact, in the United States, the survey suggested the North American looting problem was especially understated in the literature, and that it was associated and deeply intertwined with the illegal trade and production of methamphetamines. The archaeologists responding to the survey noted that looting doesn't tend to happen just once, but rather often happens several times at the same site over the course of time. Other notable perceptions of the archaeologists surveyed were that efforts to curb trafficking on the supply side were thought not to be generally working, and that there was little first-hand evidence of the involvement of organised crime or terrorists in site looting, although that's not to say that this sort of involvement may not be occurring further up the trafficking chain in the transit or the transport phases of trafficking, which obviously the archaeologists surveyed would not have had access to. So let's leave the top left quadrant and move on to quantitative market studies. Most quant studies of the dynamics of the market for illicit antiquities have focused on trying to quantify the presence or absence of provenance information. Provenance is the documented history of the chain of ownership of an object. Quantifiable evidence of provenance includes excavation and ownership histories of antiquities in both private and public collections, museum accession records, and details in auction catalogues. Most of the quant research, focusing on the provenance of objects in the antiquities market, uses the information found in auction catalogues, museum acquisition records, and exhibition catalogues. One of the major studies in terms of quantifying the market was David Gill and Christopher Chippendale in 1993, who analysed Cycladic figurines in museum exhibition catalogues. They found no provenance information for most of the objects, and only 10% of the objects had documented and verifiable archaeological context. Gill and Chippendale concluded that most of the objects were looted, and that some of those which were not looted were fake. Their contribution is important because it was the first to use this quant method to expose the problematic collecting practices of private collectors and museum institutions. And they followed their 1993 study with another quant study, this time of museum catalogues and collector exhibitions, and this study went further to support previous findings. It's important to remember the context for this. In 1993, trade actors were generally suggesting that the market was mostly a legitimate one, dealing in mostly recirculating objects, in other words, those from old collections. And this study of Cycladic figurines did much to call attention to the weaknesses of that trade argument and to show that, in fact, most of these objects did not have provenance information and were therefore probably looted. So we're now in the top right quadrant, quant market studies. Elizabeth Gilgan in 2001 studied the provenance, in this case the archaeological find spot, of over 3,000 Mayan antiquities offered for sale in auction catalogues. After the enactment of the 1991 emergency US import restrictions on Mayan material from Guatemala, Gilgan found that the provenances listed in auction catalogues were often manipulated in order to avoid laws which prohibited the sales of objects from specific regions. So, for example, instead of listing an object's real provenance, where the specific site it was found at would have been problematic, a similar provenance would be suggested, but it would be broadly regional instead of location-specific. And this would make the sale appear to be legal. In this way, provenance information can, as Neil Brody has said in 2012, be the problem rather than the solution, since it can be used in such a way as to confound legal controls. Vinnie Norskoff in 2002 did quite a famous quant study of the provenance of over 18,000 antiquities in auction catalogues, and she analysed European and American museum collecting practices over a 50-year period from 1954 to 1998. She found a significant reduction in museums' antiquities acquisitions during a time that coincided with heightened awareness of the museum ethics standards as a result of the enactment of UNESCO 1970, the ICOM 1970 statement, the Philadelphia Declaration, the Harvard University Museum's 1971 threshold recommendation, and the Archaeological Institute of America's recommendation for adopting what has come to be called the 1970 rule. In addition to finding a reduction in museum antiquity acquisitions during this period, Norskoff also found, firstly, a rise in provenance information offered in the catalogues over time, from virtually none at the beginning of her time frame in the 1950s to roughly half at the end of her time frame in the 1990s. And she also observed peculiarities in the way popular objects seemed to appear in private collections, but were almost entirely absent from public auctions, And she then concluded that collectors were purchasing fashionable items clandestinely from what she termed the invisible market. And it's worth noting in passing that the so-called invisible market is something that we have really very little serious evidence about. Most market quant studies have been of the observable so-called legitimate market in auction catalogues, for example, and museums. Trade actors tend to argue that provenance information is often known but withheld from catalogues or public documents for business or for personal reasons. Neil Brody in 2006 quantitatively studied the market in Iraqi antiquities after 2003 and argued that this supposed withholding of provenance information for business or for personal reasons was not the most likely explanation of his data. He suggested a more likely explanation was that the Iraqi objects he studied had no provenance because the provenance was either unknown or tainted. In a later study, again a quant study of Iraqi antiquities, Brody documented academic involvement in the trade and concluded that academics facilitate the illegal market by studying and providing detailed descriptions for objects which increase their market value. And the market would diminish in profitability, size, and destructiveness if academics began to take this aspect of their involvement in valuations and authentications and other aspects of study of antiquities more seriously and work to address this type of facilitation of the illicit trade. And similarly to survey of archaeologists' experiences and perceptions mentioned earlier, some researchers have attempted to survey the opinions and experiences of dealers and other participants in the market. I did this with Penny Green in 2009, and among our findings were that dealers didn't generally know the detail of the law criminalising trading in looted antiquities, and that their practices were quite heavily routinised and resistant to change. So steering the market in a positive direction through legal intervention is difficult as a practical task for these sorts of reasons. Qualitative research, now we're moving into line number two, left-hand side. Qualitative research at source has involved recorded interviews, participant observation, and informal conversation using an ethnographic approach, in other words, trying to understand the world through the eyes of the people who are experiencing it. After the invasion of Iraq in 2003, Joanne Farchak-Bailey went to actively looted sites there and found subsistence diggers who admitted to having left their families in order to camp on site and dig for money. Some of the looters were heavily armed, working in gangs, and she concluded that as long as the economy is depressed and people are deprived, looting in Iraq would persist. Hers isn't the first observation of local people in source countries digging as a result of poor economic environments or political conflict. 35 years ago, Dwight Heath in 1973 studied Costa Rican looters and their activities and found that his subjects looted to support themselves financially. Heath was quite sympathetic to the communities that he studied, and his study laid the groundwork for the eventual development of the term subsistence digging, which has come to be quite a popular term in the literature now. 20 years after his Costa Rican study, David Staley in 1993 lived with the people of St. Lawrence Island and arrived at similar conclusions regarding the diggers there. In Belize, David Matsuda, in a very famous study, studied 400 part-time farmers who looted archaeological sites when they had no regular agricultural work in order to supplement their part-time farming incomes. He found that most of the diggers were from economically and politically disadvantaged groups. They were either indigenous or refugees who relied on looting to provide subsistence for themselves and for their families. And Sam Hardy has produced an interesting study in 2011 of the divided communities of Cyprus and found that the problem of the illicit antiquities trade there exploded during the intercommunal and paramilitary conflict from the 1960s to the present. So depressed economic conditions clearly play a central role in looting as a subsistence activity in most archaeologically rich areas, but there are exceptions. Internationally powerful and economically stable countries such as the UK and the USA are both source and market countries, and the reasons for digging archaeologically, or the reasons for digging in a clandestine way of archaeological sites, are often different. Some metal detectorists in the UK, for example, find that digging for treasure is a hobby, so it's nothing to do with subsistence. Thanks to these contributions and to others, we know that in most cases, looting is the result of a combination of several factors: demand for archaeological antiquities, a marketplace for antiquities, political conflict, social marginalisation, and economic deprivation. Qualitative source studies are important because they shed light on the nature and the scale of harms caused to local communities. They illuminate the socio-economic, the cultural and the political context of looting. And they help us understand the personal motivations of diggers and the different circumstances and jurisdictions in which they're sometimes officially considered to be criminals and in other places they're not. And then we have interviews with market actors, qualitative market studies. At the market end of the chain of supply, qualitative research with market actors is preceded mainly by way of research with key players, supplemented by ethnographic observation of the way relevant markets work. Morag Kersel, in 2006, conducted a multi-sited and historically situated study of the legalised and regulated market in Israel. She found that beneath the appearance of a regulated market, illicit antiquities were still traded. And in fact, the method of regulation and control in the market presented useful opportunities for object laundering. Permits to trade specific objects were reused multiple times in order to facilitate the passing of illicit objects into the regulated marketplace. And this qualitative market research is where my main empirical contribution has been in this field. Over the last 10 years or so, I've been interviewing high-end dealers in a series of studies of market and transit locations such as New York, London, Hong Kong, Bangkok, Australia, Switzerland, as well as other key market personnel like museum buyers, police officers, and so on. And these conversations with significant traders in the market can be quite revealing in terms of allowing us to consider the motivations, the routines, and the moral outlooks of market participants. And in particular, the interesting thing that has emerged is the structure of justifications which surrounds the purchase of looted antiquities, either knowingly or more often with a serious degree of suspicion about their illicit origins, but not clear knowledge people will buy looted antiquities. And this takes us into interesting psychological research around the levels on which people can suppress or ignore troublesome knowledge, which in practice in the antiquities market is made easy by the culture of privacy in transmitting provenance details during a sale and purchase. As I mentioned at the start, there are a significant number of contributions in the area which are not reports of original research, but they deal with issues of legal and policy reform, often incorporating secondary data analysis, in other words, working with other people's data, and often making recommendations towards solutions to the problem of the illicit trade. Some of these I'll address in a moment, but it's worth mentioning, I think, two of them here, because we won't mention them again. Matthew Bogdanos, who is active in recovering objects looted from the Baghdad Museum during the Iraq War, and Robert Hicks, who suggested that looted sites can be treated effectively as crime scenes, and therefore forensic types of police analysis of these crime scenes are perhaps appropriate. There's a lot of media output in relation to this topic. The extent to which that should enter an empirical review is arguable, I suppose. I think there are many studies which have had a substantial impact on the way that academics think about the problem. I'll mention four of them. Karl Meyer, in 1973, wrote a path-breaking study which, aside from his depth of attention to the issue, is notable in that it cemented the issue that the antiquities traffic was an effect of a global marketplace. And we've heard some points on that this morning already. Peter Watson's book in 1997 revealed significant knowledge of exploitation of trafficking mechanisms within a major international auction house, thus revealing the incontrovertible link between the legitimate public face of the antiquities trade and the illicit source of cultural goods which feeds it. And more recently, we've seen widely read popular books from journalists like Roger Atwood and Felch and Framolino, which have told in impressive detail some of the significant stories of the illicit market, including the looting of Sipan in Peru and the major official investigations of high-volume traffickers such as Medici and Aquino. So if that's the empiricism, let's talk very, very briefly, 5 minutes, about the theory. In considering the theoretical orientation of scholars who've written on the market, it's perhaps useful to start with a threefold division of the theoretical perspective which has been developed by the literature on crime prevention theory. This is the division between legal, social, and situational interventions designed to prevent crime. I'm going to work my way backwards through this diagram, so we'll start with the legal approach. A review of the literature shows that most of the writing on policy developments in the control of the problem of trafficking looted cultural property has come from within the legal community or adopted a legal perspective. Key authors include Lyndall Prott, Patrick O'Keefe, Patty Gerstenblith, John Merriman, Stefano Manicorda, David Murphy, Paul Bator. The legal approach tends to revolve around recommending new laws to deal with the illicit trade, and often these are criminal laws. So, for example, in 2003, as part of its package of measures implemented on the ratification of the 1970 UNESCO Convention, the UK passed into law the Dealing in Cultural Objects Offences Act, which introduced a criminal offence of dealing in tainted cultural objects while knowing or believing they were tainted, with an attached prison sentence of up to 7 years. Other legal recommendations have included proposals to harmonise laws to address problems of jurisdictional incompatibilities in deterring traffickers, and at the extremes, proposals which are quite controversial, to reverse the burden of proof so that a buyer would have to prove that an object was not looted rather than a prosecutor would have to prove the object was looted. Social crime prevention tends to look not at reforming the law, but at changing the sociological context in which offences take place. The idea here is therefore to address the drivers of problematic action in question, or in plainer language, to understand why people are doing the problematic things that they're doing, and to try to influence the social landscape so that this becomes less likely. Major ideas here include education, both of local source populations in caring about their heritage, and education of buyers and consumer nations, raising their awareness of the legally problematic and unethical nature of the artefacts that they might want to buy. Often these proposals have been put forward by members of the archaeological community or anthropological scholars and activists. And then, in contrast to the legal approach and to writing on social measures, we have situational crime prevention. There's been comparatively little written on situational crime prevention in relation to the antiquities trade. This is really target hardening, and probably the reason why so little has been written is the well-known practical and resource difficulties in protecting remote archaeological sites. So, let me show you a long list of criminologists. I should say, I'm sort of skimming through the references here, but there is a written paper that goes with this, with the full references, so if anybody wants to see this literature review with all of the full references to follow them up, I'd be very happy to provide it to them. I can't go through all of these because I don't have the time, but let's start with John Conklin. He used an approach called routine activities theory in 1994 to present his analysis of the illicit market, which in its most basic format requires that three things be present for a crime to take place: a motivated offender, a suitable target, and the absence of a capable guardian. In this formulation, the answer to how to prevent crime would be to either demotivate the prospective offender, possibly through some of the education mechanisms we've mentioned, to do something to alter the suitability of items of cultural property as attractive high-value objects for theft and smuggling, or thirdly, to introduce surveillance or protection measures at some point in the chain of illicit supply that would amount to some form of guardianship or enforcement of legitimate behaviour. These are fairly basic ideas. They've been developed by other criminologists in more recent scholarship on the subject. Thinking about the idea of suitable target in the absence of capable guardians, for example, Edgar Tehus developed what he calls a lock model, which calls attention to the interface between the legitimate and the illegitimate in the market. Other criminologists have made this observation too, calling the antiquities trade a grey market, as opposed to a fully legitimate trade, which might be considered to be white in colour, or alternatively, the black markets that are often talked about in relation to organised crime. And then there are more recent developments, including some of the work that we're doing in the Trafficking Culture Project at Glasgow, which consider the problem as an issue of a transnational criminal market. And within this concept of a transnational criminal market, we can see various types of crime. At the demand end, we have white-collar crime, as wealthy and powerful individuals and institutions provide a financial incentive for looting that drives the market. So with the concept of a transnational criminal market is an economic perspective, which considers the market to be an important unit of analysis, as opposed, for example, to the arguments we hear put forward by the trade quite often, that controlling looting in source countries is the appropriate point of intervention. So we have white-collar crime in market countries, and this labelling brings with it a whole raft of tools to understand the social forces supporting that type of criminality. These include cultures of acquisition within organisational settings like museums, which raise questions common to other types of white-collar crime analysis, such as whether the problem is with particular individuals who have a tendency towards wrongdoing, or with structural dynamics of the overall institution in its wider social context that mean that anyone in the position of running acquisitions practice in a certain institution would be subject to pressure to make purchases which are problematic. And this white-collar crime perspective also helps us dispel the myth that high culture in market countries is a sanitized realm of worldly and sophisticated art appreciation, since we can now see that in some substantial measure it is subject to the same neoliberal capitalist forces which dominate and shape all aspects of global consumptive culture. And a paramount explanatory variable in the analysis of social action in which an economic component is present is usually whether there's an opportunity to make a profit. Within the concept of a transnational criminal market, of course, we're invited to look not only at the market end, but at transit and at source. I don't really have the time to talk about that, but I can certainly discuss it with people if they're interested. So I'll wind up there. Let me finish by saying, aside from thanks for listening, I'm here with a PhD student, Jessica, and part of our project at Glasgow, there's the website, we're also on Facebook and Twitter and other sorts of social media. Part of our project is in trying to tap and develop both a database of evidence, qualitative and quantitative, and secondly, to canvas suggestions and expertise for regulatory futures and useful policy developments. So given that we have a range of experts in the room, if you feel you can spare the time to sit down with us for 10 minutes at some point throughout the course of today or tomorrow, we're here tomorrow as well, we would very much like to conduct a short informal interview with you, either on the basis of collecting evidence to add to our database, which will all be published through the website, or alternatively to hear your views and have an informed discussion on possibilities for regulatory futures, which will of course be what emerges out of this conference also. So thank you very much. Sorry for running so late.